Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to 10% Happier early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
I suspect that most of us spend very little time thinking about the emotional lives of judges. Even when we see them on TV, they're these kind of remote figures sitting up on this elevated platform wearing robes. You know, maybe we're aware when Judge Judy's in a bad mood, but they, of course, do have emotional lives, and they're making incredibly important decisions. And I heard recently that there's a little bit of a movement in the judiciary to adopt mindfulness. And one of the guys who's kind of at the forefront of that is Jeremy Fogel, who's a senior United States district judge in the Northern District of California, who's currently serving as the director of the Federal Judicial Center in Washington, D.C., which is an education wing of the judiciary. They basically do education for judges. And he's a meditator, and he's trying to get other judges to do it. And so I give you Jeremy Fogel. From ABC, this is the 10% Happier Podcast. I'm Dan Harris. I always ask everybody the same first question, which is, how and why did you start meditating?
Well, it was about 20 years ago. I think it was just my wife and I were both interested in kind of developing more ways of centering ourselves and making our lives more reflective. And so we actually got involved in mindfulness meditation and in yoga right about the same time. Hmm. Took some classes. And
so it didn't have anything to do with being a judge?
No. Well, I mean, being a judge had a lot to do with it in the sense that I felt that my job put me under a lot of stress. And that it required a lot of complex decision making, and I was looking for a way of getting some space and centering myself. And I had studied meditation in a different context. I was a religious studies major in college. I was really interested in those subjects. I studied Eastern religion, so I was aware of Zen. I was aware of meditation in that context, but I'd never done it. I mean, it wasn't a practice that I had. But the idea of having a practice that kind of gave me a way of getting space was something I sort of intuitively made sense to me. So it was something that when we kind of decided together to do this, it was with some enthusiasm. And yoga really has, which I've also done pretty much since then, has had the same effect. And I've kind of chosen, I like yin yoga. I like the restorative, reflective, not so much the athletic stuff, and more the opportunity to really use it for deep relaxation. So I took a mindfulness meditation class. It was the Jon Kabat-Zinn 8-week program. Thought it was great, and continued doing it. It was something that made sense. It came pretty naturally, and never have stopped. I mean, I think in terms of my consistency, that's really varied depending on what else has been going on in my life, but I've always found some time to meditate.
Every day?
No, not every day. That's why I say the consistency has varied. I mean, there have been times where I've meditated every day. There have been times when I've meditated 2 or 3 times a week. I think I'm more in that latter category now. But one of the things that's happened is that it's less formal and more like I'll find moments in my life. Like I'll be at work and I'll notice I'm a little bit off center and I'll close the door to my office and I'll take 5 minutes, that I'm doing more of that rather than having a structured practice of sitting for a certain number of minutes a day.
What do you say I'm feeling off center? What do you mean by that?
Well, I think one of the benefits of having meditated is that I have a sense of equanimity. I have a sense of where I want to be. I'm present. I'm in the moment to a fairly good degree, and there are times when things happen. Either I'm very tired or there's something that's happened in my life that's upsetting or distracting, and I just notice I'm not feeling that way. I'm not feeling the equanimity. I'm feeling more emotional than I normally do, or I'm feeling more anxious than I usually do, or something doesn't feel lined up with where I usually am. I mean, I think that's been one of the effects of having done this for a long time, is I have a place that I am most of the time that feels quite stable and where I'm happy being.
And how back in 1996, how long did it take for you to start feeling more centered, to use your word?
Oh, quite a while. I mean, when I talk to people about meditation now. I say, you know, it's very, very slow growth. You know, it's not like you start doing it and a week later, you know, your life is completely different. You know, that it's a very gradual process. And there's a story that I tell when I talk about meditation to people is I had done a couple of the 8-week classes, and I was waiting at a red light near my home, and it was a long light, you know, it was a small street feeding into a big street, and I was looking at the light, and I was looking at the light, and I said to my wife, I said, you know, that light is really red. You know, that there was like some way that I noticed, you know, that I was just more aware of the situation I was in. And I think that's when I started to notice that it was having an impact. But, you know, to really get to this, and I really describe it as a sense of equanimity, that's taken years. And I think it's just the process of constantly coming back to a place where I can feel things very intensely. It's not like I don't feel things, but that they don't stick, that I can just notice that they're there and let them go.
What was you said your job at the time was pretty stressful. I know you've kind of switched jobs a little bit, which we'll get into in a second, but yeah. your job at the time was you were on the district court in the Northern District.
Actually, it was right before that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
I was still on the state court. Gotcha. It's called the Superior Court in California, and I was that's the general jurisdiction court for the state. I was doing complex civil cases, and I was also doing some fairly heavy criminal cases, and the state courts do most of the major felonies. And so I had a number of cases in that job that really were quite demanding. They were emotionally demanding, physically demanding. And then right about that time, actually, right around the time I started doing meditation, I was nominated for the district court. And that, you know, people followed judicial nominations, they know that it's a stressful process, a lot of politics, and there was then, there is now, and so the process of being vetted for that position and having my background check and coming out to D.C. to go to the Senate hearings and, you know, all of that was actually quite stressful. In addition to my day job, I had to deal with that, and it was great actually having something that I could use as a refuge from that.
So 1996 is well before this became a corporate phenomenon, a cultural phenomenon, an athletic phenomenon.
Right.
You were ahead of the curve here. So did you tell anybody you worked with that you were doing this thing?
I met another judge right around that time and I don't even remember how it was that we discovered we were both meditators. And actually, she'd been doing it longer than I had. But I've always done a lot of judicial education. I mean, it's how I got to my present job, which we'll talk about. But I was teaching state judges in California, and they were primarily dealing with judges who were doing family and juvenile cases, which anybody who's been a judge will tell you are probably the hardest cases to do. I mean, you'd think it would be a murder case or something like that, but actually the ones that really demand the most of you in terms of emotional intensity and just trying to keep your head if you sort of get a contested child custody case or you get a juvenile dependency case. And I was teaching a class that was basically about coping strategies, you know, how to do cases like that and maintain your equilibrium, not impose your personal biases on them. I mean, really try to handle them in a thoughtful way. And so people talked about how hard the cases were, how demanding they were. And we were saying, well, what can you do to deal with that? And, you know, there are various ways to reduce stress. And one of the judges who was in the class volunteered that she meditated. And I think it was part of her religious tradition. She was Buddhist, and she was part of her religious practice. But, you know, then we talked afterwards, and, you know, I said, well, I do that too. You know, and it wasn't something that one kind of went out and broadcast. You know, it was definitely sort of viewed as an alternative kind of practice, alternative way of living.
And so now obviously you're pretty open about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what changed?
Well, I think the world changed. I think people really, you know, one of the things that I like about mindfulness meditation is that its origins are completely secular, that it was something that was discovered in kind of helping people deal with chronic pain. And not discovered, but the application was for people with chronic pain. And another sort of personal path for me is I used to have, every spring, I would get really bad hay fever. I was allergic to various kinds of pollen in the San Francisco Bay Area where I lived. And you know, April and May were just torture for me. And I actually was able to desensitize myself through meditation. I don't get those allergies anymore. So it's, you know, it sounds like one of these miraculous things, but it really wasn't. It was just noticing that there was an emotional component to my allergic reaction, and it had something to do with that and something to do with my, you know, how run down my immune system was. And so I was able to notice that, and then I was able to do things to take care of myself, and over time it went away. So I think a lot of people have had experiences like that. I think a lot of people have either been able to deal with chronic pain, they've been able to deal with chronic stress or various kinds of illnesses. And then there's all of the performance enhancement stuff that's happened, you know, you mentioned in the corporate world and in the military, that people learn that actually centering yourself and calming your mind can make you work more effectively and be able to think more clearly and deal with stressful tasks more accurately. One of the military folks I've been working with lately is a fighter pilot, you know, and she she trains people to fly supersonic aircraft, you know, and it's just really interesting to hear her talk about mindfulness, because it's like, you know, nothing could be sort of a more immediate thing than having to, you know, navigate at that kind of speed, and just having really having some additional bandwidth, which is one of the things you get from meditation, I think, you know, and I think that's what's been discovered in the corporate world, you know, and that's why, and in athletics, that's the other, I didn't mention that, but I mean, that's the other place where, I mean, there's been several professional sports teams, successful ones that are, where that's part of their training. So it's been interesting to see that happen.
And then there are the New York Knicks, not so successful,
but
they do meditate.
I was thinking of the Golden State Warriors.
Yes, well, right. The Bulls and the Lakers, who came before the Knicks in terms of Phil Jackson's career.
Right.
First of all, I love the term extra bandwidth. That's really cool. Mm-hmm. So you went from being a state court to a federal court district judge to now moving, you now have moved from Northern California to Washington, D.C. And this actually has a pertinence to meditation that we'll get to, but just so that we can follow the chronology here. And so your current job is what?
Well, so there's an agency called the Federal Judicial Center, which is actually a statutory agency. It was set up by Congress 50 years ago. And it has two primary purposes. One is to do policy research for the federal judiciary so that we can advise the policymakers, like the Chief Justice and the Judicial Conference of the United States, on best practices and how to manage the courts, not what kind of decisions they should make, but how the courts ought to be set up and managed and how the workload ought to be managed. And then the other major mission is educating all of the people who work in the judicial branch. So it's all of the judges at every level, plus all of the administrative staff, the clerks of court and the probation and pretrial officers and everybody else who works for the courts. So we actually have a fairly large constituency. And I think one way of thinking about the FJC, that's what we're known as, Federal Judicial Center, is it's kind of like a university within the judiciary, which has the traditional functions of a university. We do a lot of research and we do a lot of teaching. And so I was selected to be the director of that 5 years ago, and that's what caused me to move to D.C.
And in that role, you actually did an interesting thing, which was you published – well, I'll let you tell.
Well, so, you know, I've been – the last 5 years that I've been there, I've been kind of been slowly trying to think through a modern curriculum for judges. And, you know, I think when I talk to members of the public, they usually think, well, you know, you're learning about the law. And actually that's – a relatively small part of what I mean when I talk about a curriculum for judges, because under our system, most of the people who become federal judges are very accomplished lawyers before they become judges, and that's kind of how they get to be judges. So they know the law pretty well when they get there, and what they need in that respect is updates, and you know, if there are new developments, they need an opportunity to get that, and if there's an area they didn't get in their practice, then we need to offer that component. But primarily what people need is they need education about how to do the job, that you're in a very different position when you're a judge than you were as a lawyer. You're not an advocate. You have to be a neutral. You deal with a very wide variety of cases. You might be an expert on environmental law and know nothing about criminal law, or you might know something about one particular culture, your own usually, and not anything about somebody else's. There are ways to communicate. You know, how do you write a good opinion? How do you make a good oral ruling so that people not only feel that you've been fair, but they feel heard and understood? So there's a lot of skills that go with the job that people don't necessarily know when they come to the job. And then there are some parts of the job that are quite challenging emotionally. Sentencing is the one that people always mention, that when you're sentencing people in a criminal case, it sometimes can be very heart-wrenching, you know, when you're sending someone to prison for a long time and, you know, you see their family in the courtroom and you realize you're not just punishing somebody for committing a crime, but you're also separating them from their family, and their spouses or their kids don't necessarily have any culpability, and yet they're suffering too. And you have victims of crime who've suffered terribly, and you have to deal with their situation. So, you know, there's a lot of emotional stress around sentencing. And so a lot of what our job is to figure out how to help judges deal with those things. And at some point after working on this curriculum for a long time, I've been thinking about this over the years that I've been there, that mindfulness actually has something to contribute in this area. And so I wrote a very short article about some of the ways that mindfulness can be applied to the work that judges do. And, you know, up till now, you might see this at a judge's workshop. You know, it's a health and wellness thing. It's a way of reducing stress, just like running or you know, other kinds of exercise. So there's been some mention of it there, but there hasn't been a lot of attention paid to how mindfulness practice could actually help you with the job itself. And that's what I wanted to talk about.
And you were a little nervous about doing it.
I was definitely nervous about doing it because, even though, as you suggested in an earlier question, I mean, mindfulness has become more mainstream, it's not so mainstream in the judiciary. And I've always been a little self-conscious of the fact that I'm from Northern California. You know, I was worried that people would stereotype me as being from the land of the counterculture. You know, and I really did not want it to be taught that way. I didn't want it to be perceived that way. It seemed to me that it's a tool, along with all the other tools we try to equip people with. But it's a tool that has some very specific applications to judicial work. And so what I talked about in the article were three things. One was that it helps you deal with repetitive tasks in a more thoughtful way. And again, for people who aren't familiar with the courts, you know, one thing, I mean, all judges do certain things over and over again. You know, if you're presiding over a criminal calendar, you'll take a certain number of guilty pleas every week. If you are a bankruptcy judge, you will have so many dozens of hearings with debtors to confirm their plans every week. If you're a magistrate judge, you'll have bail hearings, many of them in the course of a week. And those functions actually are very, very repetitive. That if you've been a judge for a long time, you know, they start to take on a sameness to them. For the people who are in court, however, it may be the only case they have. It may be the only contact they're ever going to have with the court. Hopefully, if it's a criminal case, it is the only contact they're ever going to have. And so it's a really big deal to them. But what happens to us with the repetition is it feels very routine. And I think one of the ways mindfulness can really be helpful is sort of the notion that you approach every moment anew. You know, you approach it with a beginner's mind. And that construct, I think, has been very helpful to me, and I think it's very helpful to others too. It's the idea that, you know, I haven't counted how many guilty pleas I've taken, but I've been a judge for 35 years. I've probably taken thousands of guilty pleas. But sort of the notion that this is the first one I've ever taken, you know, kind of thinking about it that way or approaching it that way. And that not only helps me see more and take in more, you know, kind of go back to my red light example, you know, I'm seeing more of more texture and more in the whole situation. But what it's communicating to the defendant or to the other people in the courtroom is that I'm really there, and I'm really present, that I'm not just sort of processing something. So I think that's one of the ways that practicing mindfulness can help judges do their jobs better. And then another thing, and it's a big deal these days because our country is becoming so much more diverse, is cultural awareness, that it's real easy to, especially if you're under stress and you're really busy, to just assume that when somebody does something, it has a particular meaning. And so the example I give in the article is making eye contact. And, you know, as most of us in the U.S., we kind of think eye contact is a sign that somebody's being truthful with us. I mean, there's sort of it's the way we're wired to see it that way. Well, I've learned from some of my international work that there are parts of the world where people just don't look at you. You know, looking at you is actually an act of hostility. You know, you wouldn't do that unless you knew somebody very well. And so, you know, you can't fill in the gaps of culture if somebody doesn't know that there's a cultural difference. But what I think being more mindful allows you to do is to not make assumptions about things. You know, that you see somebody relating to you in a particular way, and you don't just assume that what they're doing has a particular meaning, that you have a more non-judgmental approach to the interaction.
What about unconscious racial bias? I mean, aren't there discrepancies here in the way sentences are meted out?
Well, absolutely. I mean, that's, you know, unconscious racial bias is a huge topic in judicial education. It's a huge topic in the judiciary. And, you know, I, as I've said many times, I don't know that I've ever met a judge who didn't want to be fair. I mean, it's kind of like it's a basic job description, mm-hmm. you know. But there are ways we can be unfair unconsciously, and it's a hard one to get at because, you know, what do you mean I'm being unfair unconsciously? If I'm trying to be fair and I'm doing my best to be fair, what do you mean I'm not being fair? You know, and so there's a natural defensiveness people feel sometimes, and I think one of the things that slowing down your mind and being more mindful allows you to do is to allow for the possibility that you are looking at the situation through your own lens, which I think, in fact, we are, but it allows you to do that with less resistance. I guess it comes with the territory. As you become more mindful, you realize that what I'm seeing, what I think I'm seeing, is what I'm seeing. It's not necessarily what the other person is doing or experiencing. So you gain more space. I mean, I need to say here that it doesn't make up for lack of information, you know. In other words, that if somebody's from a very different culture from you and you don't know anything about that culture, you could be the world's most mindful person and you still wouldn't know what you don't know about that culture. Mm-hmm. So I think there is an educational element when you're talking about bias that mindfulness doesn't get at. But I think it slows you down enough that you can allow for the possibility. One of the things that I really find helpful, there's a book by Daniel Kahneman called Thinking Fast and Slow, and he talks about System 1 thinking and System 2 thinking. And you System 1 is your sort of intuitive, reactive way of thinking. It's just it's your habits of mind, and System 2 thinking is reflective thinking, where you actually think about the data you're taking in and you reflect about it. And what happens, particularly when you're in high-stress jobs, is you almost naturally track into System 1. And we all do it, and to some extent, we need to do it. I mean, you don't have time to think about, you know, whether you know, you're going to get run over by a car crossing the street. I mean, you see somebody coming at a high rate of speed, and you react to that. So our reactions serve a useful function, but sometimes they're wrong. And you know, when you're in a job like I'm in, and my colleagues are in, where you're making decisions that really have impact on people's lives, slowing down your mind actually, I really believe, helps you do your job better. And I think it's true in the area of bias, along with many other things. You just don't you don't react so quickly. You give yourself a little more time to be reflective. And then I think if you add to that the opportunity to get cross-cultural education, which we're really trying to do as well, just to get people to tell stories, you know, to learn more about each other's life story, then you can combine those things, and I think you really can get at racial bias and other kinds of bias, gender bias. You know, it's hard work, but I think it's I think mindfulness enhances it.
Huge issue.
Yeah.
As they say at Amica, empathy is our best policy. Whether you need auto, home, or life insurance, they're ready to help you protect the things that matter most to you. They're a mutual company, customer-owned, in service to you. Amica representatives are here when you need them, and you can take comfort knowing a real person will be there on the phone to take care of you, because the greatest measure of their success is your satisfaction. You can count on T-Mobile to help keep you connected. After investing billions to light up their network from big cities to small towns, T-Mobile is America's largest 5G network. Plus, when you switch to T-Mobile, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus Verizon and AT&T. Visit your neighborhood store or T-Mobile.com to switch. Plan savings with T-Mobile. Third line free on essentials via monthly bill credits versus comparable available plans. Plan features may vary. Credits stop if you cancel or change plans.
So how did that article go over, and is mindfulness taking off in the judiciary?
Before I answer that question, I just want to say there's one other point, which is important, and I think it's important I make it before I answer your question, because I think this is the one that people really relate to, which is the emotional. There's a psychological term for it, emotional regulation. So you know, somebody does something that upsets you, and so you talk with judges around the world, not just around the country. You talk with judges around the world. Bad lawyers upset us. Unreasonable parties upset us. Dumb cases upset us. You know, there are certain pet peeves that I think judges all have, and it's not uncommon that if it gets really bad, you respond to that. You show your emotion. You react. You are cross with somebody, or you yell at them, or you are discourteous to them, or you somehow communicate your displeasure in some way. And sometimes that's really not appropriate. I mean, it's not, you lose that sense of judicial demeanor that everybody kind of hopes for when they come to court. So one of the arguments that I make in the article, and it certainly has been true for me, is that having more bandwidth, as I said earlier, having more space allows me to have more equanimity, so I can notice. It's not that I don't get irritated. I do. But I notice that I'm irritated before I express the irritation. You know, I notice it, and I have a little more time to say, "Oh, you know, this lawyer is really starting to make me mad." You know, and so, and then I can say, "Well, what am I going to do about it? You know, am I going to ignore it? Am I going to take a recess? Am I going to say something to the lawyer?" But if I say something to the lawyer, I want it to be considered and dignified and modulated and so on. So you have more room to do that, I think, as a result of a mindfulness practice.
Right. Respond, not react. We talk about it all the time.
That's right. That's right. So, and I might mention, you know, my wife has been a preschool teacher for many years, and so she worked with 2-year-olds. And, you know,
is that harder or easier than dealing with lawyers?
Well, I think there's similarities. I mean, and I don't mean to disrespect either lawyers or 2-year-olds, you know, but I mean, it's like there are real challenges in working with young children. And I think she would say that, you know, she gained a lot more equanimity as well, and just had a lot more patience, and you know, was able to to just take it as it came. And
you know, I know I asked a question earlier that we then had to set aside because you wanted to list this third thing. But so now I'm going to even take us further down the tributary. It just it strikes me sitting with you that I don't know that members of the public empathize with or think much about judges. Mm. Yes, Judge Judy is a huge figure in our culture or whatever. Sure. But I don't know, like when I'm watching a courtroom drama, the person I'm least drawn to on the, in the frame is the judge.
Right.
I'm thinking about the lawyer. It's all about the lawyers and the defendant.
Oh, that's right. And you know, in fact, our Chief Justice once said, you know, the judges are sort of the umpire. No, no one goes to the game to see the umpire.
Right.
I think in a trial, you know, the umpire analogy is actually very good. I mean, it's a little different for appellate judges because they are making legal policy kinds of decisions. But as a trial judge, which I've been my whole career, you really don't want to be the story. But at the same time, you are, in a way, you're kind of a symbol of the legitimacy of the entire system. This is another thing I've written about. It's a different article, but you know, we don't have a state religion. We don't have we have a very polarized country politically. I mean, particularly now, but I mean, we have at other times in our history as well. But one thing that people generally accept is the idea of the rule of law. We accept the legitimacy of the courts. You know, when the 2000 presidential election, when the Supreme Court decided who was going to be president, you know, it in some countries there would have been a revolution, you know, but it didn't happen here. You know, a lot of people didn't like the decision, but people accepted the decision, and I think, you know, we're very fortunate, and I say this as somebody who's done a lot of international travel. We're very fortunate that our courts are as respected as they are. One of the reasons that the courts are respected is I think we have a very professional judiciary. I think people really take it seriously. Most of the judges I've had the privilege of working with take the job very seriously, and so we're symbols of the institution. And I think in order to really do that job as well as we can, you know, we need a number of things. I mean, it doesn't hurt to be smart. It doesn't hurt to be efficient. It doesn't hurt to be brave. It doesn't hurt to be compassionate. But I think having the ability to be self-aware is a very important part of it, too. And I think it's more important now than it's ever been because of the things I was talking about, because of the diversity of society and because, you know, this in some ways I think the courts are the glue that holds our society together sometimes. And so judges need to be, you know, they need to be on their game. They need to be thoughtful, reflective, as fair as they can be. And I really think mindfulness is a terrific tool. It's not the only tool, but I think it's a terrific tool, and it's well suited to what we do. So you asked earlier what the reaction has been. Very interesting. I was nervous when I put the article out, and what I found was a lot of people related to it. I got a lot of unsolicited feedback from people, and not just people on the coast. I mean, I got emails from people in Alabama and Indiana and places like that. I mean, there was just sort of this sense of a lot of people around the country either having a practice or being interested in it and feeling like something like that was something that would enhance their lives. So I just this summer spoke at two, they're called circuit conferences. They're gatherings of the judges and lawyer representatives from the different regions of the country. So we spoke at the Ninth Circuit and the Tenth Circuit.
I think I was supposed to go to one of them, and I was too busy to go.
Yeah, both of them are in the West. The Ninth Circuit is the West Coast and some of the inland states, and then the Tenth Circuit is the rest of the inland mountain states and then in Kansas and Oklahoma. And so we gave presentations, and then at the Tenth Circuit, we actually had a voluntary practice session the morning following the presentation, and I had no idea what was going to happen. You know, I thought, you know, we might get three people. We got over 30 judges.
Wow.
Yeah, from around the Tenth Circuit, and they were really interested. You know, they said, yeah, I can see where this would be useful to me or relevant to me. So we actually did a little practice, and we had some discussion afterwards. And then this summer, another program that I was involved in was in Oregon. It was a national workshop we did for court unit executives. So it's like essentially the clerks of court, people who run the clerk's offices in all of the federal courts, and the chiefs of the probation and pretrial offices around the country. And they work with the criminal defendants. And we had about 250 of those folks and did a mindfulness program for them, and then had a practice session the next morning, and had really good turnout as well. And I think people just, I mean, they find it relatable. I mean, they say, yeah, you know, I can see where one of the things I struggle with is, you know, being, you know, just having moods, you know, having, you know, being, you know, being distracted by emotion, or being distracted by worries. And, you know, thing is, you know, as people say, I mean, you're either in the past or you're in the future. Your mind is somewhere other than in the present. And that having a greater ability to be in the present really does enable you to do your job better. It isn't, I think the initial interest people had is it was as a health thing. It was a way of reducing stress, which it's great as a health thing. I mean, it was how I got into it, but it has professional applications, and I think that's what's interesting. I mean, I think that's what's starting to be seen in a lot of different areas of life. I mean, you mentioned, we talked about them earlier. I mean, medicine's another one. I mean,
yeah, and know, the legal community. Law schools are teaching this now.
Exactly.
There are lawyer websites.
That's right.
Mindful lawyer.
That's right.
I don't know if I'm getting that right. And in fact, yeah. I think I saw a website about dedicated to judges who are trying to spread mindfulness within the judiciary.
It's probably one of the ones for the state judiciaries.
I see.
But yes, I'm aware that there are people doing that. And would like to actually link up with them. The National Judicial College, which is in some ways an organization that's similar to the one that I'm involved with, but it's an educational resource for judges of state courts. And it's, in addition, not all the states have really robust judicial education just for budget reasons. And so this is a national organization. It's a nonprofit that does judicial education. They're having a mindfulness retreat in, I think, in November, 4 days. You know that they're getting people to out in Arizona.
So, it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
Great.
So you know it's pretty interesting to see how it's becoming more mainstream. People are less embarrassed about it, I guess. I mean, there's nothing to be embarrassed about. I mean, it's one of the things I always tell people is it's a totally natural process, and it's. I mean, some people are interested in whether it's got any religious overtones or not. And I said, well, mindfulness per se doesn't, you know, but you can look in almost any faith tradition and you can find it, you know, that it's part of the practice in many of the great religions.
Yes, but, you know, there have been some lawsuits filed against public schools.
Yes, yes.
Filed or threatened, the argument being that there are sectarian overtones. What, do you have a view on that? I mean, it's going to bubble up to the courts.
Well, I think so, and I think you have to be very clear that that's not what we're talking about. I've seen those cases. In fact, a couple of them were in federal court. They thought, I think there was a yoga class, you know, in a school, and the salutation at the end of a yoga class, namaste, was a religious statement. And you could make an argument, you know, because it comes from a Hindu tradition, but I think, you know, I think we're being very careful. I think it's funny how this comes up for me. It's not, because to me it's completely secular and always has been, but I have colleagues, judges will approach me who they themselves are, you know, they have a religious affiliation. They say, well, how is this different from prayer? How is this different from the contemplation that I do is part of my religion? And then we'll talk about it and say, well, no, actually, it's quite similar. It has many of the same elements. And so how you choose to do this is, you know, it's you really find your own comfort level. It's not like there's only one way to do it. But the thing that I think all mindfulness practices have in common is the is the being in the moment. It's having a practice that gets you in the moment.
But do you think there's a legally acceptable, constitutionally kosher way to get mindfulness into public schools?
I think so. I mean, I don't know how a court would view it because it would depend on the particulars of what
of the program
of the program.
Yeah, but you could do if the programs were correct. You think
yes,
it's possible?
Absolutely. Because I think if you do it correctly, it's got nothing to do with religion. I think the problem is that this is one of those areas where people have very strong opinions and very strong emotions. You know, so someone could misread. I've been doing yoga for as long as I've been doing meditation, and it has absolutely no religious significance to me at all. It never has, you know. But it's. I suppose if somebody wanted to see that in that way, I mean, they could make that argument. So I don't mean to minimize the possibility that somebody might see it that way. But I think if you teach mindfulness to a diverse audience in the right way, that there is no reason why it couldn't be part of a curriculum in a public school.
So give me a sense of what your – I know you say that sometimes you practice every day, sometimes you don't. But when you do practice, what do you do? What kind of meditation? How long?
Move? It's variable. I mean, my optimal is 20 minutes. I just use bells. Don't use any kind of guidance.
Like actual bells that you're ringing personally or on
phone? I actually have a recording.
Okay.
I have a recording of bells. And they're kind of the – very nice resonant bells that, you know, have long lingering sounds.
And, so it gets you do a bell to start and a bell to end.
Correct.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. And other than that, it's just breathing.
So you mean you're watching, you're feeling your breath coming in, going out, and then when you get distracted, you go back.
That's correct.
And that's it.
That's it.
That is the classic MBSR technique. And just to say a word about that, because you mentioned this was pioneered by Jon Kabat-Zinn, who's
right.
I always forget if he was a micro or molecular biologist from MIT. Somebody corrected me on this on Twitter recently, and I obviously didn't take it in or wasn't being mindful when I read it. But anyway, John, phenomenal guy, started he was a Zen practitioner, but was also studying in the Theravadan tradition too at the Insight Meditation Society up in Barre, Massachusetts, and had a moment of insight while practicing on retreat that, hey, we could teach this. Strip out all the Buddhist lingo and just teach it, you know, because, the Buddhists describe mindfulness well, but they don't own it, just the same way that algebra was described very well by the Muslims in Baghdad or whatever back in the day. But, it is a universal phenomenon.
That's exactly right. And as I mentioned earlier, I studied Zen not as a practitioner, but as a student of religion many years ago. I actually did take a Zen meditation class. I think it was 8 or 10 weeks. It's very similar. I didn't really notice much difference between that and what I'd been doing. It was interesting to see that. I see some subtle differences, but it wasn't anything real significant.
It depends on the form of Zen meditation. Yeah. If they're having you do koans, it might feel a little different. But Shikantaza, I think that's probably what they taught you, which is just kind of a
breathing.
Breath. Yeah.
Yep.
I'm not a Zen expert by a long stretch.
Yeah.
But so let me ask you one last question, and then beyond this, we can just either let you go, or if you feel I've missed something, we can talk about that. But how well does mindfulness is all about non-judgmental awareness, seeing what arises in your mind without getting caught up in it. Dispassionately, non-judgmentally, right? This is the skill that we can develop. It's our birthright, but it's a skill that we can hone.
Right.
How does that jibe with your job, which is to judge?
To judge. Well, it's a great question. You're not the first person who's asked it. I guess where I would make the distinction is that the judging of my own thoughts, my own feelings, my own reactions gets in the way of my being able to see the situation as it is. You know, that what I'm kind of looking for is as clear a view of what I'm being asked to think about as I can possibly get. And I want to get the clutter of my own stuff out of the way. Once I've done that, I still have a job of trying to analyze what it is I'm seeing, and say, well, does this have any legal significance? You know, or am I, if I'm evaluating who's telling the truth, you know, or I'm trying to decide whether a situation that I'm being presented with falls under a particular set of case law or something that I have to follow. So I still have to go through an analytical process. And if it's a situation where I'm being asked to exercise some discretion, like I'm trying to decide, should I give somebody probation or send them to jail, you know, or should I, how long should I send them to jail for, you know, or that kind of thing. I still have to do that, but I'm bringing less of my own baggage when I do it, you know, that it, which is not to say, I mean, I'm still me and I still have all of the strengths and weaknesses that I have as a human being, but there's less extraneous clutter. That's the way I would put it. You know, it's like I can look at it and say, wow, this case is really hard, you know, but let me try to think about this. Let me try to unpack it. And it's, I'm just much better able to do that if I'm not dealing with my own inner voices, you know?
Yeah. So, I mean, that was beautifully articulated, yeah. And I think it really speaks to one of the fears that people have about meditation, which is that they're going to be rendered into some lifeless, non-judgmental blob. They'll be ineffective. They won't have any edge. But the point is not so that you, is not to make you incapable of making decisions. The point is that you can make decisions. You can have enough non-judgmental awareness of your emotional churn so that you can let it go when you come to make a decision.
Precisely. And you know, I caricatured it in that way before I'd ever done it. I mean, I remember thinking about it when I was a college student because, you know, I was studying this stuff. And I said, you know, you can meditate and, you know, you can be all, you know, blissed out and everything. But, I mean, you know, what happens when, you know, there's an injustice going on in the world? You know, or what happens when there's a situation that requires you to deal with it? I mean, you need to engage. You need to do something. And I think that was a caricature. That was a mistake on my part in how I thought about it. That it isn't about, I mean, some people want to go, you know, sit on a mountaintop and bliss out for weeks at a time.
But I would love to do that.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I'd like to do that too, but I'd like to do that by choice.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
rather than that sort of being everything that I think, you know, and, you know, you, like, I have two children. I mean, being a dad, you know, being a spouse, being a judge, being
grandfather,
you know, all of that, the more presence I have, I mean, the more I can give of myself for those things. And, you know, still have plenty of emotions, but it's, I think the idea that you can decide that you have some consciousness about it and you can think about how you want to express the feelings that you're having instead of it just being, you know, whatever imprint you have from your childhood or, you know, traumas that you had in your life. I mean, I think that's an important difference. It's an important kind of space you get from this. And so I think the idea that you're disconnected and detached is a caricature. I don't think it's true.
Agree.
Yeah.
Your Honor, you've done a great job. Is there anything I should have asked you that I didn't ask? Anything you want to talk about that you feel I didn't give you the opportunity to talk about?
Let me think about that for a second. I guess the only thing I want to add, and it's just something I'm careful about because it is my job. I have a national constituency. I mean, varieties of people who have many, many different viewpoints and many, many different jobs that they do, and there's a wide variety of people that I serve. I always talk about these things as being a tool in a toolkit, you know, that it's not that everybody has to do A, B, or C, that people come to different things at different points in their lives. I mean, sometimes people come to completely different things than other people, but I feel as an educator that it's very useful to put this tool out there, that it's something that can help people in the judiciary be better at what they do. If people choose not to do it, if people choose to do something else, if people choose to do nothing, that's their decision. That's something that I respect. And I think I just wouldn't want anyone to have the impression that somehow there's a, you know, intent here to spread gospel to people, because I just don't think that's appropriate, and it's, I also don't think that's what we're doing.
Well, you're on a podcast called 10% Happier, so we don't believe in silver bullets here. And you know, I mean, I think you stated well that this is a practice that is simple, secular, largely scientifically validated. It's not going to solve all of your problems, but it's right there and available to you, and you could. It's worth considering. I think I took that to be your message, having read your article.
Absolutely. No, I think you took the message correctly. That was exactly what the message was.
Josh Fogel, thank you very much.
Really
appreciate it. It was a pleasure to meet you.
Thanks for having me. I really, really appreciate the opportunity to talk about this.
Good luck getting this out there to some of the most important people in our society.
Thank you.
Okay, there's another edition of the 10% Happier podcast. If you liked it, please make sure to subscribe, rate us. And if you want to suggest topics we should cover or guests we should bring in, hit me up on Twitter at Dan B. Harris. I also want to thank heartily the people who produce this podcast and really do pretty much all the work. Lauren Efron, Josh Cohan, Sarah Amos, Andrew Kalb, Steve Jones, and the head of ABC News Digital, Dan Silver. I'll talk to you next Wednesday. If you like 10% Happier, and I hope you do, you can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
I'm Shimon Yai, and I have a new podcast called The Competition. Every year, 50 high school senior girls compete in a massive scholarship competition.
I wouldn't say I have an ego problem, but I'm extremely competitive.
All of the competitors are used to being the best and the brightest, and they're all vying for a huge cash prize.
This will probably be the most intense thing you've ever gone through in your life.
I remember that feeling because I was one of them. I lost. But now I'm coming back as a judge and also a kind of teen girl anthropologist. Because if you want to understand what it's like to be a young woman in America today, The Competition's not a bad place to start.
Hopefully no one will die on stage tonight.
From Pineapple Street Studios and Wondery, this is The Competition. Follow The Competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to The Competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.
Once upon a beat. Remember those stories and fables that would capture your imagination and you couldn't wait to see how they would unfold? And now, when you read them as an adult, you think some of these old tales could use a fresh spin. We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remix, and reimagine for the kids in your life today. Join me, DJ Fuse, and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, as we spin up new tales in the New Kids and Family Podcast, Once Upon a Beat. Yeah. Wondery and Tinkercast are bringing you a jam-packed, music-filled weekly party where hip-hop and fables meet. It's Once Upon a Beat. Follow Once Upon a Beat on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Wondery Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts. Once Upon a Beat.